Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on 720 WGN.
Good evening, everyone. It's Karen Conti here on this kind of transitional weekend. A little bittersweet. We have the cool wind, which feels good, but kind of makes you think what's coming soon. Roger, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi.
You know, we were talking about the adventures of Jussie Smollett, which will be a screen play coming soon. And that was big news this week that there was a special process server appointed. You guys covered that story,
yes,
right?
We did extensively. And it's just this ongoing story that never seems to end.
Well, you know, and I was asked a lot about, I was on TV all week talking about Dan Webb. You know, he's the best guy for the job. There's no question about it. He is brilliant. He has, his ethics cannot be questioned. He was a former U.S. attorney. He's done this at least six times. In fact, he was the special counsel in the Iran-Contra affair. And I don't know if you remember this, he prosecuted successfully John Poindexter, who was the national security advisor under Reagan. So he's also the lawyer, the U.S. attorney who prosecuted Operation Greylord, which put away about 76 judges and other people associated with some of the bad stuff that traditionally happened in the Cook County court system, but really doesn't happen too much anymore. So not only is he a good person for this, he is doing it for free, which is a wonderful thing. His law firm, Winston & Strawn, is a very good firm. They have about 1,000 lawyers in 16 countries, and I think he's going to do a fabulous job.
Is this a normal thing when they appoint a special prosecutor, it's done pro bono?
No, actually, it's not. In fact, in the past, he did some work for the city, I believe it was in that Koshman case, which is the case where Mayor Daley's nephew was accused and charged with, I think it was,
he
I don't know
hit
if it was
someone
the
he,
second
or who later
murder,
died.
Who later died,
yeah.
Right? And they thought the fix was in, and so he was appointed to investigate that. And, you know, these kinds of things can cost up to $1 million. Dan Webb's billing rate is astronomical. He's one of the best lawyers in the country, let alone the city. So, you know, this kind of thing could cost, you know, between $500,000 and $1 million, I could see very easily. So, you know, he said that, and I believe him, that he feels very strongly that he wants to see that this is done correctly and that we all have transparency. And as a prosecutor, former prosecutor, and as a defense attorney, he has an a vested interest in making sure that people understand what happened. And if something improper happened, he is going to make recommendations. And I think he's going to get to it quickly. I think he's going to do a very thorough job. And at the end of it, he has a number of things he could do. I mean, he could say that Kim Fox did something wrong. He could say that, you know, maybe she didn't do it all correctly, but no harm, no foul. And at the very end of it, he could, in fact, say that the prosecution was so flawed that Jussie Smollett could be re-prosecuted. So he's got a lot of options here. He's going to make a lot of probably comments about how the system worked here, what went right, what went wrong, and we're going to get to the bottom of it. I think it's a good thing for this case. And the case is not the most important case in the world, but it received so much attention that I think we all want to know what happened. We are following it, and some of the things that happened are questionable, and I don't like the idea that people think that the system failed here.
Right. It seemed like the case ended like three different times and then reopened again and then ended again. So how much time should we give him to finish his investigation, do you think?
You know, my guess is he's going to get to it in about 3 months.
Okay.
And my guess is a lot of the stuff he's going to look at has already been done because there's been other investigations internally. There are documents out there that he just has to review with his staff. And then he might want to talk to some people or take some depositions, send subpoenas out, and find out what conversations were had with the prosecutor. How was this deal made? Was it made in a normal course of prosecution? Was it wrong for Kim Fox to appoint her underling once she decided that she needed to recuse herself? What were her other options? And did that, in fact, impact what happened with Jussie Smollett in a way that was so unusual that we need to re-prosecute him? So,
but by the end, we should have a final, definitive answer.
We should, and I hope so, and I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, excellent.
So let's talk about panhandling. We've all had experiences with people begging in the city, in the suburbs, and really around the world. This week, the village of Downers Grove was sued over its law against panhandling at intersections. The ACLU and the Law Project for the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless filed suit on behalf of two men who generally stand at an intersection near Butterfield and Finley Roads, both very busy intersection. And the question is, do panhandlers have constitutional rights? With us to discuss this issue is Diane O'Connell, a lawyer with the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless and one of the lawyers bringing the suit. Thank you for coming down to talk about this.
Thank you for having me.
And, you know, again, this is something that we've all had some experience with, and there's some panhandlers who are very aggressive and some that just stand there and wait for you to come to them. Do panhandlers have constitutional rights?
Absolutely.
And tell us why, because I know that our listeners, that some of them are going to be saying, you know, that's offensive. I don't want to go into a store if someone's standing out there. What is the constitutional right to stand there and ask for money?
Well, the First Amendment to the United States Constitution and the Illinois Constitution guarantees the right to freedom of speech, and panhandling is speech. So everyone has the right to ask for help.
I'm going to give out our numbers here. If anyone has any comments or questions, we're all going to be very civilized tonight. 312-981-7200. I'm here with Diane O'Connell. Let's take a break. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about some of the laws that regulate panhandling and what's constitutional and what's not. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. We're here with Diane O'Connell, lawyer with the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless, and we're talking about panhandling. There was a lawsuit filed by the ACLU and the Chicago Coalition against Downers Grove over its panhandling ordinance. Can you tell us a little bit about the law, what it says, and why you believe strongly that it violates the Constitution?
Yeah, so the Downers Grove ordinance actually mirrors the Illinois Vehicle Solicitation Statute, which prohibits people from asking for money donations for personal use and also rides and employment near roadways. So it does not prohibit people from asking for money for donations to nonprofit organizations. It does not prohibit people from asking for you to sign a political petition. There might be any other number of things that somebody wants to ask you by the side of the street. And some of those might be very unpleasant, but they're all legal unless you're asking for a cash donation for personal use or a ride or a job.
And what's the slippery slope here? Because I know that, you know, with these kinds of organizations, you work for an organization that protects the homeless. And what is the slope that you're worried about? That if these kinds of ordinances are brought and they're kept up, what is your concern for the people that you advocate for?
Right. Well, I just think it's a very basic human issue. Think about what it means for a democratic, you know, free society to say that it is illegal for one person to ask another person for help. It's not only homeless people that panhandle. Any of us might find ourselves in a situation where we might need to ask for a ride or for a few dollars. I know it happened to me in my youth. It's just really pretty scary to have any laws that regulate the content of people's speech. And that's what, you know, that's what the First Amendment is all about.
And I'm going to read to you from some of the texters, and I knew that these would come because I was discussing this with some of my people in my environment, and I got the same, very same questions. I feel no sympathy for begging. These are adults and they are homeless people who make a choice to live on the streets. They're not asking for help. They are harassing Chicago. What do you have to say for people? I'm sure you hear this kind of stuff all the time. How do you respond to that?
Having spent about 5 years working with people who live on the street, I don't feel that it's a choice. I have met very, very few people in that time who are on the street by choice. There's a drastic shortage of housing resources in the city of Chicago for people who can't pay market rate housing. So that's one thing.
Okay, and so how many homeless do we have in Chicago, roughly speaking?
So our agency recently released a report that puts the number at over 80,000.
80,000 people. Is this Chicago or Chicago area as well?
That is Chicago.
Is that per capita similar to other cities, just generally speaking?
I actually don't have those numbers. Yeah. Yeah.
So, and generally speaking, what are the main reasons for homelessness? Is it mental illness? Is it alcoholism? Because, again, another texter said, oh, they don't use it for food. They use it for alcohol and drugs, and therefore you shouldn't be giving them anything. What do you say to that? And what are the reasons for homelessness, generally speaking?
So I think those are stereotypes about people experiencing homelessness. This idea that they're, predominantly people with mental health and substance abuse issues. Certainly, those issues do affect poor people, just as they affect people in other sectors of society. But, you know, the visible homeless person that you are, a lot of these stereotypes are linked to, really does not represent the majority of homeless people. I mean, you know, in the city of Chicago, many, many families are homeless. Many, many families are living doubled up with other families, and that's also a form of homelessness. And the primary reason is because housing is unaffordable and unavailable.
And what kinds of resources are available for homeless people? I mean, I think there are people who believe that every night a homeless person can go to a shelter and find a bed to sleep in. Is that not the case?
That is not the case. On any given night in the city of Chicago, the city-funded shelters may either be full or may have, you know, 10 or less beds. That's just... And in the winter, you know, it's very typical that they will all be actually full. And that is, provided that you could actually get to them and that they would accept you, right? So even those available beds might be in a facility that's for all men or for all women or for only women with children or things like that. So certainly there are people who are not going to fit those eligibility criteria. There is one shelter in the city of Chicago that almost always has beds. And it is a place that is not accessible for people with disabilities of various, either physical disabilities or mental health disabilities. And it's also a place where you are required to engage in religious activities while you're there. It's known to be dangerous and scary. So there's a lot of people that don't want to stay there and actually feel safer being either outside or, in some other situation, which is... also likely scary. So the options are not great.
Diane, texter says nursing homes are available for homelessness. Is that true? I would never have even thought that.
I actually don't know how true that is. I know that there are some disabled people who are pushed into nursing homes because they are homeless and don't have other options. And I know that... a lot of people find that offensive because they are not so sick that they need to be in a nursing home. They are really just poor and need a bed to sleep in.
Diane, just one final question before we wrap this up. Homelessness is something, I take it that you're in this as a lawyer to not make a good living for yourself, but to help people who are less fortunate, which is a good thing to do. What can people do? If people want to help the homeless situation, what can they do, whether it's donating money or taking some action? What would you suggest?
Well, one thing I would say is that we are fighting to increase the real estate transfer tax in the city of Chicago for the specific purpose of raising millions of dollars for homelessness. So if you're interested in supporting that campaign, you could call your alderman. It's called the Bring Chicago Home campaign. But also, you know, certainly you can support nonprofit organizations that do great work. There are many good shelters in the city of Chicago. They are always struggling. There's many organizations that do great work. And also, I feel like, you know, if you feel compelled to give money to a panhandler, you should feel comfortable in doing that, because that's what human beings do. We show compassion and we share with each other.
Diane O'Connell, thank you so much. Diane O'Connell is an attorney for the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless. Thank you for coming in and sharing
with us. Sure, thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN.
Because I'm happy. Clap along if you feel like a room without a roof. Because I'm happy. Clap along if you feel like happiness is the truth.
Because some people seem to succeed in relationships and are very happy, stay happily married, stay happily with a significant other. And some seem to fail. Some seem not to be able to find anyone. And I've always wondered, being a family law attorney in my professional life, how much is being happy in a relationship about selecting the right person, and how much is it in how to deal with that significant other once you are in that relationship? And with us today to talk about that very interesting issue is Jeffrey Sumber, who is a Harvard-trained licensed psychotherapist, relationship consultant, motivational speaker, life coach, and educator. He spent the past two decades studying relationships, consciousness, personal transformation, self-worth, and empowerment. He's the author of a book, Renew Your Wows, which we are going to be giving away in a little bit. Jeffrey, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I'm going to get right to my question.
Sure.
How much of a good, successful relationship is picking the right person as opposed to conducting yourself a certain way once you're in that relationship?
That's an awesome question. And the answer is two-pronged. The first part is, yes, you need to find the right person. And I believe there are many people that could fit that right category. The issue is, do I feel like 50% or more of my needs are met naturally? Now, I like to shoot for 60% to make it a really good fit. But if 50 or above of your needs are met, then you work for the rest of your life to get the other 50 plus 40 or 50 left met. And so the second part of the answer is, are both people willing to work at it? And that's a huge question for so many couples. Am I willing to move towards your needs?
And it's interesting, because as much as you hear those types of things being said, marriage is hard work. You have to work at your marriage. You have to work at your relationship. I still hear very intelligent older people say, the magic wasn't there. I dated him once on the app, and you know, I sent him in, the sparks didn't fly. And so therefore, I mean, you know, is when you're saying needs being met 50% or 60%, mm-hmm. I think a lot of people would say, wow, I thought they're supposed to meet all my needs. What do you say about that?
I say that's a Disney movie.
Yeah.
I think we have this fantasy, and so many people, they move the dial towards divorce so quickly, because as soon as you realize that, wait, 100% of my needs are not being met daily, right? And the measure is, well, it's not every minute of every day that 60% of your needs are being met, right? It's an overall sense. And there is a reality that after a while together, sometimes our desire wanes in terms of how hard we're willing to work. We get triggered, we get frustrated, we get resentful. And without really communicating about those, what we call stuck places, then we really can feel like, wait, did I choose the wrong partner? When actually we're so stuck around the hurts that we've accumulated that we've lost our mojo to keep working.
And I sense that you're an optimist.
I am.
and as am I. But you know, being in the business of family law, I see so many people who are in such horrible trauma with their relationships that of all different types. You know, and sometimes I think, how did these two people get together? How did they even get together to have children? I don't,
sure.
You know, it's astounding to me. Do you think, though, that in most cases, you can help people even if they've had four or five really bad years? Where is there a point of no return where you just can't get it back together?
Obviously, there is for some couples. Just, you know, we waited too long to get to you and we're just past that point. But I would say the vast majority of couples who are still interested in possibility, they're still curious, that little thread, I always ask couple, is there a thread of hope I don't care if it's the tiniest little bit, but if you're willing to at least stay curious as to what if it could be different.
And I suppose if both parties agree to come to counseling, that is a good sign.
That is a good sign, and it's very rare, actually. Almost always, one partner is facilitating the counseling appointment. It's very rare when the other person is, absolutely, we totally need to do this. And it usually takes a session or two for that other partner to get on board. When they don't get on board after a couple of sessions, I start to question whether there's going to be enough buy-in.
A very common dynamic that I see is one party will say to the spouse, I need you to go to counseling with me. Let's go to counseling. Let's fix this. We've got children. I want to fix this. Let's make it better. This is for, you know, this is supposed to be forever. And the other partner says, no, there's nothing wrong with me. And then they go, and then they try to get the other partner. And then finally they say, well, I'm going to have to divorce you. And then the spouse sometimes goes, oh, okay, I'll go to counseling now. Mm-hmm. And then by that time, toothpaste is out of the tube a little bit, and there's a point of no return.
Yeah.
I see that dynamic a lot, and people are resistant in some cases to go to counseling. Why? What are the common reasons that people don't want to do this?
Well, we used to blame it on the stigma of counseling. I'm not crazy, so why would I need counseling? We're fine. We can work it out, even though we haven't for years. And I think what it comes down to, the more I've done this, is that people are just afraid of the vulnerability that counseling requires. I mean, I'm going to have to look at myself and the things that I can't blame you for, right? That's terrifying for so many of us, myself included. When I've gone into counseling, it's just, even though I do this for a living, it's just a very vulnerable, naked feeling of, okay, I have to own my own part of this.
We're talking to Jeffrey Sumber, who's the author of Renew Your Wows, which I'm going to be giving away. And when we come back, I want to talk about a concrete example. I'm going to talk about how perhaps you should be talking to a significant other. And again, I think some of these bits of advice can translate into the workplace and other places in your life in making conversation and with saying things in a way that doesn't cause a trigger in the other person to sometimes put a barrier up and not get the problem resolved. So when we come back, we're going to be talking about that. You're listening to WGN.
Imagine me and you, I do. I think about you day and night. It's only right to think about the girl you love.
I'm here with Jeffrey Sumber, Harvard-trained licensed psychotherapist and relation consultant, among other things, and the author of Renew Your Wows. We're talking about relationships, and I want to give an example, and this is something that you address in your book on how to better communicate with your loved one. So, Jerry, my husband, his ears perk up. Jerry, my husband, is working out of the home. I come home from a long day of work, 10 hours a day. I come home, and there he is. He's sitting there. He's got a drink in his hand. He's watching TV. His feet are up on the bed, and he took the clothes out of the dryer, but he didn't fold them or put them away. The garbage bag is still sitting by the door where I left it in the morning. He took his clothes to the cleaner, but gosh, he forgot to take my clothes to the cleaner. And I come home, and I'm angry, okay? I'm angry, and I say, can't you just do something? I just worked 10 hours, Jerry. You're just so selfish. This is how you always are. This is what happens all the time. How many times do I have to tell you to just do this to make me happy? Okay. And you say, Karen, edit that.
So this is one of the most common challenges in any long-term relationship. We believe that the other person is responsible to meet our needs. And so when I say 50% are met naturally, that doesn't mean that they're trying. It just comes naturally. We think that they're supposed to meet 100%, and that's where we get stuck. So I have to first differentiate between a need and an expectation. I need to feel loved. I need to feel appreciated. I need to feel thought about, right? And so when Jerry doesn't remember to take your clothes into the laundry, it's feeling like he just doesn't care about you, right?
It's not about the clothes.
Exactly.
Right?
And yet we make it about, you didn't take out the garbage.
Okay.
You didn't do this. And so when we express those feelings, it ends up coming across as a blame, a criticism, a judgment. And who wants our beloved to sit and tell us that we're not good, that we did it wrong, right? Instead, what I would encourage all of us is to express the need in a clean way, like, I need to feel loved. I don't feel loved right now, right? Or I'm feeling neglected right now.
And Jerry says, why, Karen? Why don't you feel loved? Right. To which I respond,
it's really hard for me when I have this fantasy that you're going to think of me all the time, right? And when you don't, it kind of breaks my heart.
Oh, Jerry's not feeling any guilt over there.
I don't want Jerry to feel guilt. I want Jerry to understand you. And that's this whole process is really giving you what we actually call the process that differentiates from the problems that we all have, right? But if we use this process, which is really a system of communication and understanding, a lot of these problems just get funneled through something that we agree, this is the way we deal with this.
Because the way I just spoke is going to cause other problems, right?
Of course.
And that's going to make him resentful and think I'm a nag, and then he's going to stop listening altogether probably whenever I say anything.
Yes. It's what we call a reaction complex, right?
Okay.
I ping-pong back and forth your reaction, my reaction, and after 10 rounds of this, we don't even know what started it.
So the thought is, if I say, I would feel more loved if you would recognize that I have these needs, I've had a long day, and then Jerry's going to say, oh, I really love her, so I will do these things for her. And I didn't understand that this made her feel like she's not loved.
If I feel like I'm being demanded upon in order to get that love flowing between us, then I'm going to feel resentment. And so the goal here is for me to want to give you your needs, for me to want to give you the gift of, oh, I feel really thought about and like I'm important suddenly.
Let's switch topics a little bit and talk about the process of finding people. And given my age, I'm in an age group where there's a lot of my people in my age group are largely, if they're not married, they're divorced or widowed, and they're having trouble finding a mate. And mm-hmm. they're on some of the dating apps, which are difficult. And I see a lot of people who have what I call the list. And the list is, this is what I want in a person. He has to be over 5'10". He has to be Jewish. He has to be either a doctor, lawyer, or an accountant. You know, I'm just making these things up. But there's a list of what has, I like, he has to watch sports. You know, beer is good, but not more than 4 glasses of beer. What do you think, and you see people like that, right? That counsel who have this list of what they need and what they want.
Yes.
Your book addresses this issue very well. Tell our listeners how that is not a good way to think about the world.
So the problem with that is that if I say I want this catalog, right? I want this catalog and everything in it. What are the odds that that's actually going to arrive on my doorstep just the way I thought about it, right? It's not. The focus needs to be, who am I and what am I doing for me? How do I fulfill my own needs? What are my needs? How am I feeling today? Do I wake up happy? Do I feel content at my job? Am I showing up as the kind of person someone would be attracted to? The rest of your list works itself out. We all have needs. The crux of all this is, do I feel good with this person? Not do they meet my criteria?
Right. I mean, that makes sense because, as we all know, you can have a list and all of those things on the list can be irrelevant when you meet the right person.
Yeah. I had a client recently, about a year ago, actually, and she walked into my office with a spreadsheet, Excel spreadsheet,
oh my gosh,
of all the quote-unquote boys, she called them, that didn't cut the mustard for her. And we just basically threw that out, and we spent a year working on her and all the things that she needed to get unstuck around. And now she's in an amazing relationship, and she's happier than she's ever been. We have to get rid of the lists.
Yeah, and I think, too, I see people who have been through a bad divorce, and I'm not saying it's easy to get through those things. It is very difficult.
Sure.
But I see a lot of people with a lot of bitterness, and they hold on to it, and they just appear to be unhappy. And I would imagine that is a hard place to come from when you're looking for someone. You know, you can see people with that on their face.
Yeah, and I would encourage you to not look for someone at that point, right? If you're still bitter, if you're still hurting, it's a perfect reminder that you've got more healing to do. And if you're healing still, what do you have to offer someone else? When we're in a recovery process, we have this a fantasy that the person that we meet is going to fix it all for us, and we're right. going to feel great all of a sudden. And all we do is what we call a bypass. We just bypass all the pain and the hurt, and then we just have to deal with it again later.
Right.
So, oh, yeah.
Let's get to a couple bullet points before we have to break here. What is codependency? We hear that word a lot. What does this actually mean, and how does a person become codependent? I know this is a big question.
It's a huge question, and I think codependency has gotten a bad rap. I think that as Dr. Sue Johnson, who created emotionally focused therapy, as she says, we humans are homo vinculum. We're actually bonding creatures, they who bond. And we need each other. We need to feel healthy, safe attachment with our significant other. And so a little bit of codependency goes a long way. It's a really healthy thing when I know I can depend on you without demanding it or expecting it. It's just a natural flow between us. What gets awry is when I expect it.
Okay.
And so codependency is, if I don't get it from you, my life falls apart in my mind.
Right? Okay. Interesting. And you talk about, your website says that you help people through grief. I've been in a situation where I've had a husband die, and it's been a horrible grief. Things are good now. But no two people grieve the same way. I know that. And going through that process, I saw people try to tell me how to grieve.
Yeah.
And I will never do that again with other people. How do you help people through grief?
I first and foremost remind them that grieving is not a normal daily thing. It is an abnormal experience. And so there is no normal way to deal with an abnormal experience. So however you need to do it, it has to be okay. And so many people, whether it's the loss of a loved one or even a loss of a relationship, there is a grieving that occurs. Loss of a job. We go through grief
right.
on so many different levels. And people around us, what we hear from them is, you're doing it wrong.
Just yes.
like we hear, you didn't take out the garbage. Where we're really trying to say, I just don't feel you anymore. And you seem so sad, and I don't know how to help. And so I miss the connection. And so instead of saying that, we say, when are you going to stop this?
Right. Or you should.
Or you should.
Yeah. You should go out now.
Right.
You should do this.
Yeah. Don't should
do
on
that.
Me.
Yeah. yeah. Don't should on me. And finally, summer's coming to an end, and we know what's next. Seasonal affective disorder. Is that a real thing?
Yeah. I think I have seasonal affective disorder.
I think I do, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a day in September every year here in Chicago where it's that day in the middle of 90s that it hits 55 suddenly.
Yes.
And I just start to go, oh, no. And I start to take more vitamin D. I put that sweater on every morning. I just, everything changes, and I start to, you know, curl up inside waiting for what's coming. And so I think there's a lot of people who whip out the, you know, the sun lamps and I try and plan for a vacation every month, just get away for a weekend if I can, just somewhere else, even if it's Wisconsin and more snow, just somewhere out of my routine.
Yeah, I think that's a good plan if people can possibly do that. Now, I get it. I start dressing in black. I know when I've reached it because it's like, it's just black.
Yeah, earth tones come out for
me. Yeah, that's right. Jeffrey, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
Jeffrey Sumber, the author of Renew Your Wilds. Where can people get your book?
It's on Amazon. It's on Apple. It's out there.
And if you are interested in counseling or couples counseling or singles counseling, where would people reach you?
JeffreySumber.com.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Karen.
Lots of listeners texting and calling to get the name of our last guest, Jeffrey Sumber. And his book is called Renew Your Wows, Jeffrey Sumber. Thank you for joining us. And now is the time I will be answering your legal questions. If you have a question for you, for a loved one, for a friend, or if you have a comment about a news story, something that is of interest to you, I will help weigh in on that. The number here is 312-981-7200. Text to that same number, 312-981-7200. And in case you don't get through, but you probably will, it's a quiet night tonight, you want to talk to me at the office in private, my number is 312-332-7800, 332-7800, or better yet, email me with the details of your issue, and then I can get right back to you in an email. And that is wgn@askkarenconti.com. AskKarenConti.com. We've got some calls here. Hi, Paula from Naperville. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Hey, Karen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I always find your show interesting, and I have a reason to call you.
Okay, great.
So my situation is yesterday I opened up a package of frozen spinach, and in it was a piece of plastic that's like 2 inches long and a half an inch wide. And you can see that it's rough on the edges so that it broke off in some way.
Wow. Okay.
How do I contact the manufacturer so that they can recall this batch? Do I have any legal recourse? It's not like I ingested anything.
Right.
Before I did.
Good question. And I don't know if you saw this, but I believe it was last week. This was on the news. Someone had bought salad, pre-prepared lettuce, and there was a little tiny frog in the bag. So this happens. This kind of stuff does happen a lot, and I do get this question. And here's a couple things. One is, I think that would be your good thing to do. Your good Samaritan thing is, I would first of all take pictures of it. I would take it into the grocery store where you bought it, show it to them, and see what they will do. And maybe they'll tell you what they're going to do or not do. I think a lot of people are afraid of lawsuits, so maybe they're not going to tell you anything right to your face. But I would also send it to the manufacturer, go on their website, find out who might be the legal counsel or the head of consumer issues, and send an email to them with the picture and tell them where you bought it. And tell them that, this is what's going on, and that someone could really hurt themselves or swallow that. And if it were a smaller piece, it might even not be detected until it was too late. As far as legal recourse, Paula, unless there's damage, meaning if you had chewed it up and broken your tooth or swallowed it and had to go to the hospital, there would be a lawsuit. There's really, interestingly, a lot of people don't get this, is that there is no lawsuit for them being negligent. Certainly, that should not be in your bag of frozen spinach, but good that you didn't hurt yourself. From a lawsuit standpoint, though, there is no lawsuit without that damage, that piece of I was injured by your negligence. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Call me back and let me know how they reacted, because in my experience, some of these manufacturers don't get back to you. You never know if they were heard. And people who do this feel like they're doing a good thing, which you are. You don't always get a good response. I mean, if I were in that position, I'd say thank you very much. I'd send you enough frozen spinach for the rest of your life and be thankful that you did the right thing. But I appreciate the call. Thank you, Paula.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Let's go to Kathy in Franklin Park. Hi, Kathy. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. But I know of two people recently who had been given offers of jobs, and the people went and gave a 2-week notice to their current jobs. And in the case of one of them, I know he spent a lot of time going down, taking off from his current job, going downtown, going to the meeting and the just different things that he had to do. And then the day before he was supposed to start, the place called him and said that they don't have the funds in the budget, that they were not going to be able to hire him. Now, the other person, I don't know very many details, but it's just somebody who told me he had resigned from a job and then got told that the new job would not hire him, or they couldn't go through with the hiring. So is there any kind of law?
You know, it's interesting. There must be something in the air, because I actually got that same question posed to me last week. I believe it was a telephone call to my office. And the answer is not a good one. You would think, right? Someone gives you an offer. You go in there, you transition, you give your job in 2 weeks' notice, you plan your new life, and all of a sudden they renege the offer. That's a bad thing. There's really nothing from a legal standpoint, because you're an employee at will. Even if you don't even start working there, they can fire you the first week you're there for any reason except discrimination or something like that. So having made an offer and taking away that offer, there's no legal right to that. I mean, you could try to assert your rights to say, listen, I left a job. I'm now without a job. I'm going to be out of work for 3 months. I need some compensation, or you need to do something to help me. You could try that. I doubt the employer is going to do anything. And really, that sounds like there would be a lawsuit there, but there really isn't. And I'm sorry to give you that bad news.
Okay. Well, all right. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you for the call. Yeah. Sometimes I'm the bearer of bad news, and it's not always a happy thing. Along those same lines, actually, I had a caller last week who was 65 years old, and she says she's working at a small company, and her employer keeps saying to her, oh, when are you going to retire? You're gray hair and all this stuff, kind of in a friendly way. But she said to me that she felt that they were trying to drive her out, and can the employer force her out? And there's no policy in the handbook about mandatory retirement. She doesn't want to retire. She can't retire because she needs the money. She's not able to, she didn't save money her whole life. And so now she's got a situation where she needs to work. And I say that's absolutely age discrimination. If there is no policy, even policies might be held to be age discrimination. As long as you're doing your job, and there's no reason that your age poses a burden on you doing your job, if you had to go lift things or something like that, if you're doing your job and you're getting performance reviews that are good, you should have your job, and they cannot fire you based upon your age. That's just not, and they shouldn't even be saying those things. And what I generally tell people is to educate your boss. And this is a small company that the woman is working for. So sometimes they don't have an HR department that knows all the laws, but you could say to your boss, listen, and do it in a real friendly way, I'm 65 years young, and I would really like to keep my job. I'm doing a good job. You know I'm doing a good job. I just got all this, these raises or commissions or whatever you want to say. And say, you know, when you make these comments, you know, you can't do that legally. That's age discrimination. So maybe we stop talking about my age. And, you know, say it in a way that you know is going to be well received, but you also need to say it in a way that makes the person say, oh, I can't do this. This happens more often than not. And I hate to see it, because there are a lot of people in the workplace who are over 65 who are doing a great job and need to and want to continue to work. So hopefully that'll help some of you out there. I am taking your legal questions, 981-7200. The phone lines are open. You'll get Ben. Ben will kind of triage your question, find out exactly what the issues are, and I will try to get to them. 981-7200. We'll be taking your calls all the way through 9 o'clock. This is the Karen Conti Show on WGN. In the middle of the night, I go walking in my sleep. From the mountains of fame to the river so deep. Taking your legal questions, 312-981-7200, or text to that number, 312-981-7200. An 847 texter said, years ago, I bought a box of broccoli from Market Day. In it was a bolt. I send a note to the company saying I knew there was iron in it, but didn't expect to see it. I love that. That's very funny. J.D. Simplett IV came to my house with a case of all of their products. Classy. Yeah, J.D. Simplett IV. He is like one of the top 90 millionaires in the world. I think he's worth billionaires, I guess, $3.5 billion. So, yeah, handled perfectly, right? So now you're probably a customer for life, I would bet. Hi, Karen. I'm going through a divorce, and my husband was ordered to pay child support and maintenance. He once again got fired from his job and on his own determined that he can stop paying maintenance. He did not go to court and get it ruled on. He has no household expenses because he lives with his mother. Okay, well, you see this all the time. I don't know if your husband is a person who loses his job periodically, but you see that during a divorce. A lot of times you'll see a spouse, and it goes both ways, will lose a job. Oh, I can't support myself. I need your help. And or I can't pay support myself because I don't have a job. And a lot of people think that that's going to fly with the judge. And normally speaking, a judge who sees that there is a person who has to support a spouse, and I'm not going to say man or wife because that's not the way it works anymore. It's gender neutral. And that person also has to support children. The judge might say, I'm going to impute income to you. You lost your job by your own volition or by your own bad conduct, and I think you're doing this on purpose, and I'm going to insist that you pay this maintenance and child support even though you don't have a job. So for those out there who are receivers of maintenance and support, you can have your attorney assert that position, that this money should be imputed because he's voluntarily making himself poor so he doesn't have to pay. And listen, if you have the children most of the time, I'm assuming that you do if he's paying child support or some child support, then you still have to feed them. Just because he lost his job doesn't mean the kids don't eat. So he's going to have to come up with this money if he's living with his mother. That's a secondary argument, that he has no expenses at all. He should take all of his unemployment income and give it to you, and should be tapped to go into his savings if he can't pay the maintenance and child support. So that's an unfortunate situation. And if you are in a situation where you lose your job and you can't pay support, you need to go to court and stop the court order from ticking. And it sounds like he didn't do that from this texter. And therefore, the judge is probably going to hold him to paying this money to you. But again, it's very difficult. That's a difficult situation, I understand. Let's go to Carl in Willowbrook. And I think Carl left a message for me this week on my phone. Hi, Carl.
Yeah, I did, Karen. Pleasure speaking with you. The gal pal's coming out right now, so I'm outside. But anyway, I'm a senior citizen. My buddy's a senior citizen. And his dog got chewed up and killed by a pit bull a week ago. It was on the news.
Yes, I saw this.
And, there you go, then. And I got his permission, if he saw the article or if you want his name and number. But that's it in a nutshell.
Okay.
Karen. So he wants to know if he has any legal recourse. I believe he told me that the owners have a $100,000 rider insurance policy.
Okay.
And the homeowners.
Okay, so if you have a dog that is, and apparently this dog, according to the news story, had done this before, had injured or killed a dog before.
Yes, there was prior incidences. Yeah.
Yes. So with this, there's a statute called the Child Animal Control Act. And the Animal Control Act regulates these types of things. And there's two different kinds of animals, dogs. There will be called a dangerous dog and a vicious dog. And I can't recite all of the law about it. But
not to interrupt you, these are both deemed vicious, from what I understand.
Okay. So just for my listeners, I'm going to just tell you quickly. A dangerous is a dog that presents danger and a possible danger. And then if a dog is deemed to be dangerous three times or seriously bites or injures a human being, that dog can be deemed to be vicious. And then the judge takes over and can deem the dog to be vicious and can do all kinds of things, including euthanize a dog, okay,
mm-hmm.
or require or fine the person or make sure the dog has to be kept inside and not outside and has to muzzle the dog. There's all kinds of options the judge has. So in this case, you're asking me what this person should do. I'm assuming it's traumatic to have a dog. I think one of the dogs was mauled and one of the dogs
absolutely.
Died.
Absolutely. He had two little dachshunds and, you know, the one ultimately died a week ago tonight.
Yeah, that's horrible.
And these babies were supposed to be locked up, from what I heard, and not be out running around free. could have been a lot worse.
So obviously there's been a report to the police, and I assume that, they're going to take control of it. But from a legal standpoint, when it comes to damages and when it comes to money, you can demand that he pay for the vet costs of your dog, the dog that was badly mauled, and the value of the dog who died. Now, this is where it gets very sad, because as we all know, and I'm a pet owner too, I love I love my animals. So, but if a cat or a dog dies, there's not a whole lot of what we call damage in that. How can you put a value on your dog? How can you put a value on how that dog was a companion to you or to your family? So that's something that you're probably not going to get a lot of money for, just because there's no inherent value of an animal except to you. It sounds terrible, but that's the way the law works. But certainly you should make a demand on this person. I don't know if this person willing to submit it to his insurance company to see if the insurance company will cover it.
Well, I hope so, Karen. Again, it's not me. Honestly, it's I'm calling on behalf of my buddy, because he's still sad and all that type of thing. So,
I would say put together a list of things that you want compensated for and send it to him and see if he'll give it to his insurance carrier. And you might want to hire an attorney to try to negotiate it, or have a friend help you negotiate it, because the insurance companies are all about saving money. They're not going to pay anything that they don't have to. And if you're not represented by counsel, they may not be very willing to pay very much on it. But
anybody you can refer him to, or not really?
Yes, yeah. I can. So why don't you, can you call me at the office or email me? Do you have an email?
Well, I actually called yesterday and left a message at your office.
Okay, all right, then I can call you back. I have the number then.
Yeah, because
I do remember that you did leave your number. So let
there
me do
go.
That,
back
Carl.
You.
Thank you for the call, and I'll call you tomorrow and get that done for you. All right.
Yeah, pleasure, Karen. Really appreciate it. Thank you, ma'am.
All right, Carl. Take care. You know, and some of these things, it's just hard to explain. I mean, people say, oh my gosh, if my dog died, I should get $1 million. And I kind of agree with you, but just the way the law works is that animals, just unless you have some sort of horse that has inherent value because it's a breeding horse, or you have some specialty dog that has a value for show dog or that type of thing, you're not going to really get that much money. But certainly you can try, and certainly you should put that together and try to get some compensation. And hopefully this dog will be taken care of. I mean, I hate to see dogs be put down, but when you have dogs in the community that are capable of this, and I've seen it before. I've had cases that I've seen where the dogs get out, they actually push down a screen door to get to the other dog, and they maul the other dog, and it's just a hard thing to watch. And so somebody is being irresponsible with this dog by letting the dog out. Let's take a break, and when we come back, I'm going to be taking more of your legal questions. If you have any questions about divorce, about criminal cases, about anything going on with speeding tickets, small claims, give me a call and I'll try to answer your question. 981-7200, 981-7200. Back in a minute.
Hey, a little less conversation, a little more action, please. All this aggravation is satisfaction in me. A little more bite, a little less spark. A little less fight, a little more spark. Close your mouth and open up your heart and maybe satisfy me.
Nice music selection, Ben. Like that a lot. I'm taking your legal questions, 981-7200. You're going to get on the phone with Ben. You're going to tell him your issue. He's going to summarize it for me so I can get you right on and get you some answers. 981-7200, 312-981-7200. An 847 texter said, we bought a house, and after the closing, we received the keys. We found the drapes that were supposed to be there were missing. What happens now? So I assume by your text that it was in the real estate contract, because anything that's not a solid piece of the house would probably not be included in the sale unless it was specified. So I'm assuming that that was going to be in your real estate contract. If that's the case and the drapes are not there, what you should do is you should have your realtor, or you can do it directly to the seller and say, where are my drapes? Bring them back, please. I want the drapes. The question is, what do you do if they don't bring them back, or they refuse to bring them back, or threw them away, what would the value of used drapes be? It probably wouldn't be worth it to you to bring a lawsuit over that. Certainly you're in the right if that was specified in the contract and they shouldn't have done that. That happens all the time. People get into fights about what is attached to the house. I've had people get mad about light fixtures. They take the light fixtures when they leave, or they have pots outside on their porch that are sort of attached to the stairway, and I've fought about those things. So, but unless they're very valuable, you're not going to spend money on a lawyer, but certainly it's worth it to write the letter, send the email, have your realtor do that, and see if you can get those drapes back, because the value that you would get in a lawsuit would be the value of a set of used drapes, not what it would cost to have them made new, because that certainly is much more expensive than the used drapes. Let's go to Robert in Indiana. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. Do you have a legal question?
Yes. Good evening, Karen. Just want to say I'm a longtime listener and first-time caller and really enjoy you and your advice.
Thank you.
My question is, my cousin recently went to Wisconsin for a weekend, came back, and a day or two later discovered bed bugs in the bed. And I was wondering what type of recourse would you suggest? I know it's out of state.
So he brought them back with him?
Yes.
Okay. You know, these are the kinds of things, and I say this quite a bit, and it's, I hate to sound like a broken record, but unless there's significant damages, the lawsuit is something that you don't want to bring, because you're going to probably have to pay a lawyer by the hour to do it. However, from a practical standpoint, was it a, and I don't need you to name the hotel, but was it a hotel chain, or was it like a mom and pop motel type of place?
I'm not sure, but he said it was a great hotel after he got back, and he said he would recommend it, and they had a great bar.
Well, and you know what's interesting is because I've experienced bed bugs and I've experienced fleas, and the two times that I've experienced those things have been in really nice hotels. So it doesn't really matter if you're in a Holiday Inn, you're in a mom-and-pop hotel, or you're in the Ritz-Carlton. It can happen anywhere, because
yes,
people travel through, and those things are very hard to get rid of. First thing I would do is document it. You know, have the exterminator come and say, this is what these are. This is what I need to do to exterminate these things. This is how much it's going to cost. Put that together and notify the hotel. I experienced bed bugs. Here's the picture of the bed bugs. Here's the Orkin invoice, and ask them to compensate for that. Now, listen, I think that insurance covers this for the hotel, and no hotel wants to be known for having bed bugs. And it's not like you're going to threaten them and extort them, but I think they understand that if you went public and you went on their website and said, I got bed bugs at this hotel, that would be an alarming thing that would cause people not to go there. So I think that would be the reasonable thing to do. See if you can work that out. And I think that's probably the best thing to do. All right.
And one thing I want to say, Karen, it's I never had this experience, but he said it's very expensive and it takes like 3-4 visits for the exterminator to come back.
I heard that. And actually, in my own experience, I know that they lay eggs, right? So then you have to get them at the different cycles while they're, you know, still hatching or whatever. And it's disgusting. It's really disgusting. And if you just think it's just a little inconvenience until you've scratched yourself and seen them on your mattress, it's alarming. So,
and David, Jared, one more thing I want to say. They even bit him. He had pictures.
No, I know. Yes. No, I know. Fleas bite, too. So, anyway. All right. Well, good luck to you, and let me know how it goes. I would like to know. Why don't you call me back at some point and let me know if that worked and if the hotel made good and did what they probably should do.
Okay. Very good. Thank you so much, Karen.
All right.
Thank you.
Take care. Okay. I'm going to talk a little bit. I got the phone lines open, 981-7200. I had a question from a nice emailer named Roberta. I'm changing her name. She said that she was married. She's been married for a long time, and she's very embarrassed to say that she had no clue about her finances. She didn't know what her mortgage payments were. She didn't know how much the house was worth. She didn't know what was in bank accounts, if there were retirement accounts, because her husband took care of the finances and really kind of kept them secret from her, in her view. She was concerned because she sees that they're getting notices in the mail, and she's worried about maybe he's got a gambling problem, or maybe they they don't have the money that she thought they did. But because he pays all the bills, he knows all the passwords, she feels at a loss and he won't let her look at the information. So her question was, what is her legal recourse when her husband won't tell her what the finances are or give her access? And interestingly, when you're married to somebody, there's no real recourse. If he wants to keep those things secret, obviously, if her name's on one of the accounts, she can go get that information as well. But I know in a lot of marriages, one party might do all the finances and everything's in that person's name and the passwords are all in with one person. And so that can be kept secret and there's no legal recourse. The only way that you can get access to that would be to file for divorce. And then in that process, you can request access to the bank accounts and send subpoenas and the like. I'm not saying you should get divorced to see your finances, but a little advice that I would like to give. I generally don't give relationship advice because that's not my area of expertise. It's really the legalities. People need to make their own decisions about whether you stay married or, you know, what's a good relationship or bad. But that said, I have to say money is the number one reason given for divorce and breakup of relationships. And if you don't know your finances, there's something wrong with your relationship. Both parties should know what you make, what you owe, what your taxes are, what your mortgage is, what you've saved, what you owe to credit cards. Those are all very important things in your life. And you should also have credit of your own. And I know a lot of people stay out of that whole, the finances. And then when they get divorced or their spouse dies, they don't have the ability to get credit because they've never had a credit card because they use their husbands or wives or they use cash. And sometimes people are very private about their money, even in a long-term marriage. I say, if you're married to somebody, if you're having children with somebody, you're living with someone, sleeping in the same bed, you are entitled to see their finances. And if that person won't show them to you, I think you need some marriage counseling to talk about why it is that there is this secretive type of thing going on, because there's something very wrong with that. And again, it could be there's nothing bad going on. But what if your spouse died? What if your spouse left? Well, you would need to know what is, what the status is. Let's talk to Tim in Indiana. Tim, hi. We only have a minute to take your call.
How are you?
Good. How are you doing? What's your legal question?
Fine. My legal question is, I had a guy lay a foundation for a shed I wanted to build, but the foundation was not level, so I can't build anything on it. Can I take him to small claims court?
Yes, and what you probably want to do is have another contractor come in there and write on a piece of paper, this was improperly done, give the measurements, maybe take some pictures, and say this is how much it's going to cost to either lay the foundation. I don't know if it's going to have to be relayed on top or they're going to have to actually get rid of it and start all over again, but whatever it is, whatever that cost is, should be put into an estimate. Make the demand on the contractor. If the contractor says I'm not going to do it or ignores you, then you go to court and you call this breach of contract and he didn't do it correctly, or you can call it actually negligence, and you can ask the court for the cost of having to redo that. Okay?
Okay, well, I did take pictures, but because I want to build this shed, I'm going to start all over. I've taken care of the foundation myself, but I do have pictures.
Okay, and that might be, if you took care of it yourself, you may not be entitled to an hourly wage for doing that, but you would be entitled to the materials, and you probably would be entitled to the money returned to you that you gave to him. Okay, so if that's
right,
worth it to take that person to small claims court, then again, you have to really gauge whether that's worth your time, because once you get that judgment, you still have to collect against him. And if he's going to be some guy who doesn't pay attention to this, you may have a judgment but no way to collect it. So those are the types of things you need to think about when you do this kind of thing. But thank you for the call. Appreciate
okay.
it.
All Thank
right.
You.
Now, next, when we come back from the break, I am going to do a little news quiz. I would like the third caller here at 981-7200. Do you watch the news? Do you hear the news? Do you see the news? I have some little fun questions about your knowledge of this week's headlines and news. And the third caller will be put on the line. I'll do my little quiz. And the winner will win Jeffrey Sumber's book, Renew Your Wow. So this is my guest from the 7:30 half hour. Very good book, and a special Karen Conti Show pen, which might be even more valuable. So third caller, 981-7200, 312-981-7200. to reach me during the week, let me give out my phone number and my email address. If you have questions, legal questions that I can help you with, or if you have a topic that you'd like to hear me talk about, I would love to hear your recommendations. 312-332-7800 or email me at WGN@AskKarenConti.com. And we have a contestant for the very valuable prizes, Mark from Worth. How are you?
I'm fine, Karen. How are you?
Are you feeling lucky?
I don't know.
And do you follow the news?
I do.
Okay. Well, okay. Then I think, you know, this is not the hardest one in the world. Mark, what do you do for a living? Okay.
I'm a superintendent for a union roofing company in Chicago.
Oh, great. All right, here we go. Which of these news stories is true? Only one of these news stories is true. The Amazon's distribution warehouse in South America caught on fire. B, the Chicago Fire soccer team tickets are now on sale on Amazon. C, Amazon just fired its CEO. Or D, the Amazon rainforest is on fire.
My luck just went down.
So it's all having to do with fires and Amazon.
How about it? I'm going to say D.
D is absolutely correct. The Amazon rainforest is on fire, which is really a strange news story, isn't it? I mean, it's a really horrific thing, but I think of a rainforest as being wet, and how it can be on fire is beyond me, but that is, in fact, what's going on. Very good. All right.
Yay.
This week, the government of what country collapsed? A, Greenland. B, Iceland. C, New Zealand. Or D, Italy.
Well, it can't be Greenland because we didn't buy it yet.
We'd have to buy it before it collapsed. Is that what you're saying?
I'm going to say Iceland.
You know, it's Italy. It's so interesting because it collapsed and it was on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, but and no one's really talking about it. And but yes, the whole government.
Well, if nobody's talking about it, how was I supposed to know?
Because it was on the front page of the Wall Street Journal.
All right.
Here we go. Speaking of Wall Street Journal, the Wall Street Journal reports that children are sneaking what into school in increasing numbers? A, vaping devices. B, small pet animals. C, weapons to counter school shootings. Or D, cheat sheets on their cell phones. Children are sneaking these into school in increasing numbers. Which one of those?
A.
That is correct. Vaping devices becoming a real problem with young people. All right. You're doing well. Jerry, are you keeping score? No,
67% is not well.
All right. I believe it was in the Sun-Times. Either the Sun-Times or Tribune reported that the Chicago Public Library offers certain things that you can actually borrow from the library. One of these you cannot. The rest of them you can. So the following you can borrow. I'm not asking this correctly. You can borrow the following from the Chicago Public Library. Which one is false? A, pasta maker. B, sewing machine. C, a screwdriver. Or D, a Marilyn Monroe costume. Which one can't you borrow from the Chicago Public Schools?
I have to say Marilyn.
That is correct. You can you can borrow tools. You can borrow certain appliances and a sewing machine. So there you go. You can sew your own Marilyn Monroe costume with that. Very good. Oh, all right.
Just again.
This week, NASA announced that an astronaut did this from the International Space Station, perhaps the first crime committed in space. What did the astronaut do? And it's a she. She, A, smoked a Cuban cigar in violation of law. B, snorted cocaine while in a weightless room in a space station. C, accessed her spouse's bank account. Or D, committed insider trading while on government computer. Which one is it? The first, they say, perhaps the first crime committed in space.
I'm going to say D.
That is incorrect. She accessed her spouse's bank account, and it apparently amounts to identity theft, and they're taking it seriously, and they're probably going to charge her if they haven't charged her already. Okay, all right. You were on the right track. It was some sort of financial crime. All right, here we go. Which news story here was not a headline this week in the national news? A, Fidel Castro's crocodile bites a man at a party. B, school employee used a Sharpie to color in the scalp on a student's head. C, $1 million in cocaine was found in a box of bananas. Or D, a New Hampshire husband goes on a diet, loses 182 pounds, while his wife at the same time gains 242 pounds. Which one is not a real headline?
A or D? Can I go with that?
All right. I can be loose with you. Yeah, it's D, actually. The husband gaining the weight, losing the weight. Fidel Castro's crocodile bit a man at a party. It was a gift to him, and then he gave it somewhere else, and the man was standing giving a speech, and it bit him. And yes, a school employee said the kid had a fade kind of haircut, and school didn't allow them to do that, and they colored him in. Okay, here we go. Let's go. A female scientist this week started an Instagram account to get young women interested in science using what as a lure? A, free chocolate frogs that can be dissected and eaten. B, press-on nails with designs of bacteria on them. C, microscope with slides of music and reality show celebrities. Or D, test tubes filled with Red Bull.
I have to go with B, fingernails.
That is correct. She makes these press-on nails that have designs of bacteria on them. Okay, I'm going to do this really fast, and then I have to take a break. These goods were stolen 13 years ago and have finally been recovered by the FBI.
What kind of goods?
These are goods, and I'm going to say what kind of goods were finally recovered by the FBI after 13 years after being stolen. A, the pen and paper used to write the Gettysburg Address. B, the ruby slippers from The Wizard of Oz. C, a taxidermist stuffed Lassie from the television series. Or D, serial killer Ted Bundy's diary. Which one was finally recovered after 13 years of being stolen?
There's no place like home.
That is correct. There you go. The ruby slippers have been returned to their owner. Thank you so much, Mark, for playing our game. You did a good job. You're going to be receiving Renew Your Wows. It's a great book by Jeffrey Sumber, who is just on our show, and a Karen Conti show pen. Stay on the line, and Ben is going to take care of you. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, sir.
All right. Take care.